Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:02 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 31st. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the ratio of the MSCI India versus MSCI China. There's always this big argument about whether China is going to be the next global hegemon, about China's incredible innovation and their ability to build infrastructure on a scale never previously seen in the world. And when one visits China, it's so impressive just to see how far industrialization and urbanization have come. And then when one goes to India, I can't say that I've been to India, but I've met more than a few subscribers who basically went to India and lost hope that anything would ever improve there. And we've had one, I guess, disappointment after another in terms of governance in India and the continued pace of attempting to try and improve the corruption and bureaucracy. But when we think about it just simply from raw market behavior, India continues to outperform China. This has been a factor basically indefinitely. And these are the MSCI indices that stretch all the way back to the early 1990s. But during 2020 and 2022, then India has gone into this incredible acceleration relative to China. Now, part of the reason for that is because India basically let the coronavirus rip through the economy, and because it's got a very young population, didn't feel the ill effects to nearly the same extent as other countries did, then India is treading its own path in the world, so still importing oil from Russia, but not aligned with Russia, and still very friendly with most of the rest of the world. Whereas China is becoming geopolitically isolated, and China expressing wishes to become the global hegemon is obviously creating great power competition, and there's a willingness in the rest of the world to support India as a what I think really can only be described as a bulwark against China's expansion. So basically, building up India is one of the key strategies for countering China. And the stock market has really outperformed in no uncertain terms. And then there's the additional point that India's demographics are considerably more attractive than China's, and it doesn't have nearly the same opposition to development that China does. So when we then think about the MSCI China index, well, it's accelerating lower, so that's flattering the relative performance of India. Now, acceleration's a trend ending, and it's not like this is new. This trend has been underway now for more than a year, almost 2 years, and we're back in the region of the lows from 2016, but we need to really look at lots of back history just to address the fact that this index has come back into this area on several occasions in the past and exceeded it in 2008, but subsequently rebounded. And there's nothing trendy about this chart. We have this profound downtrend from 1993 to 2002, then this exceptionally volatile ranging phase, and that's currently being the failed breakout is currently being unwound. At some point, the risk premium attached to China will have been fully priced in. And then subsequently, any kind of improving policy or any kind of just statement by the administration in China that they're more favorably disposed towards asset price appreciation, or that they're willing to spend more money to try and rescue the property market, will translate into a rebound. But the long-term trend versus India suggests that whatever rebound we get in China will be a trader's market, whereas Big pullbacks in India can be considered investment opportunities because of that long-term potential for significant outperformance relative to the other big emerging market. Then let's think about Brazil. So, when I was speaking last week, I thought that the election in Brazil would be a lot closer than the media were making out. And as we come up to, I do apologize, my keyboard. There we go. Sorry. As we came up to the election, it did look like it was going to be much closer. In fact, Lula won by 2%, and the market pulled back violently off the open, but then reversed the move. That tight margin of error, and the fact that Bolsonaro's party owns, or not owns, but dominates the legislative branch, suggests that the potential to really inhibit the outlook for the economy from the new leftist administration is going to be hampered. And the Bovespa index is rounding out here. And if it can sustain a move through 120,000, then that's going to signal a return to medium-term demand dominance and the completion of a three-year range. Then the Brazilian real has been among the steadiest currencies in the world over the last year. Initially, it paused, but then has rallied in really emphatic terms in here today. So when we think about the two big factors attached to Brazil, well, I think maybe three big factors. The first is they raised rates into double digits and did it really fast. And they were willing to take the economic pain in order to get inflation under control, and they've succeeded. So inflationary pressures have peaked in Brazil, and that gives some leeway to the central bank to begin cutting interest rates, which should help to support the financial sector, help to support consumer demand, and an economic revival. The second, I think, most important factor is that a democratic handover of power does look likely. Now, obviously, Bolsonaro is going to be smarting from having lost the election by 2%, which really only means that 1% of people have to change their minds in order to sway the decision. But the hallmark of an election in a democratic or a liberal country is that one can have faith in the quality of the result, and then subsequently that the losing party will accept the defeat and go into opposition. So it is certainly to be desired that Bolsonaro will move into opposition and sustain the demographic tenure of the Brazilian economy. But then there's the third factor, which is we are going to have to see significant infrastructure development over the course of the next decade. When we think about what China has lined up, well, they want to become independent. And that means they don't want to have to import from other countries, which means they will have to build their own. So there's going to have to be infrastructure development and duplication of processes. That's one of the biggest outcomes of an increasingly or a world that's increasingly driving towards Cold War too, that there will be duplications of processes because nobody wants to have to rely on the opposing side. So Brazil is a major exporter of soybeans. China will be certainly more preferable to buying soybeans from Brazil than it will be from the USA, and iron ore and coal and aluminium. So there's certainly the potential here that Brazil will benefit in a post-monetary tightening environment from an increasing demand for its exports. And it does look likely that the Brazilian real has room in which to outperform here. And there really aren't that many currencies that are outperforming the dollar right now. So the dollar was up in quite a dynamic manner in here today. And it paused and spent a day below 110 last week and didn't like it. So this is still a reasonably consistent uptrend with a sequence of ranges, one above the last, and a midpoint danger line stop would be required to break that sequence. So now that we have a failed downside break, well, then we can look at this underlying range, and it would at least need to pull down through the 109 level now to really suggest that we have a peak of more than short-term significance. So it's likely that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates this week, and I think it's unlikely they're going to pivot. But I do think that while 2022 has been characterized by talk of inflation, I think 2023 is going to be more about deflation. There are two reasons for that. The first is that M2 peaked about 17 months ago. And that means that money supply growth ended in early 2021. It's down now to 2.6%, and it could approach zero and potentially go negative. So that would imply that money supply is being sucked out of the market, and not only that, it's increasing at a rate less than the rate of inflation. So that's going to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures because it's going to eventually hit demand. So that's certainly one factor. Then we also know that quantitative tightening has contributed to deflationary fears twice in the past, when the ECB took 1 trillion euro out of circulation between 2012 and 2014. It contributed to deflationary fears in the Eurozone, and they subsequently had to more than double the size of the balance sheet in order to mitigate those deflationary pressures. Then the Federal Reserve engaged in quantitative tightening in 2018 and 19, and there were also deflationary fears, and bond yields were at their lowest ever, and there was real fear that the tightening up would contribute to a recession in 2020. Then we had the pandemic, and money printing went absolutely wild. And now we're coming out the other end of that. So we're seeing lots of valuations come back to where they were in 2019. But it's worth reminding ourselves that back in 2019, prices were already expensive. So it was already looking like a very overvalued market, particularly for private assets and alternatives in 2019, than it is now. And then we're going to see some contraction, but it's likely that we're going to overshoot on the downside. Now, what I thought was interesting today was that the SPAC index started to attract interest. And I'm not going to speculate about what the rationale is for greater interest in stocks like GameStop, which is one of the primary meme stocks. And the share rocked higher this morning and then gave it all up. Now, anyone with eyes can see that they are losing almost a billion in here this year, and they've got 900 million in cash. So that would suggest that they've not got all that much time left, and they're going to have to pull something big out of the bag in order to survive at all. But the reality is that with interest moving into these types of worthless companies, it suggests that there's still a lot of liquidity around. And that's the exact opposite of what central banks want. They want to try and remove that excess liquidity. Now, when we look at consumer spending, it's been rocking higher. Now, let me see if I can find the I'm going to see if I can find the nominal index. So there we go. So when we think about this trend, it clearly accelerated. And if this trend were to proceed, then it would be normal to anticipate that instead of consumer spending being somewhere around 17.6 billion, then trillion, excuse me, then it should be somewhere around 16. Now, I think this is one of the more important points because when we think about this exact same data on a inflation-adjusted basis, well, then it is back to where it was before the pandemic, and that trend has been reasserted. But of course, what this is suggesting then is that consumer spending has gone up, and consumers have not pulled back from spending. So even though prices have risen as a result of inflation, consumer spending has kept pace with inflation. And that's a self-feeding trend. So that's exactly the kind of phenomenon that the Federal Reserve wants to stop. They don't want to have a self-feeding inflationary trend, and they're trying their best to try and mitigate it. So bond yields are still in the region of 4%, and the 10-year, it didn't quite hold all of the move on the upside today, but it is still above the 4% level. And then when we think about stock markets, well, with weaker currencies in Europe, then it was a mixed day overall. The FTSE 100 was one of the better performers, and it was up about two-thirds of 1%. And unwinding the short-term oversold condition. And if it can push back up through the 200-day moving average, then that would signal that it's a failed downside break, and potentially that we could go all the way back up to the upper side of the range. Then let's think about the Nasdaq. Well, the Nasdaq rallied last week and then was weaker in here today. And we had news out of China this morning that the Foxconn factory in Shenzhou, where most of the iPhones are manufactured, has COVID, and people are leaving in droves because they don't want to get locked up. And that's not great for the ability of Apple to meet orders. And the share is pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. And this looks like an emerging top formation. It's a really significant loss of uptrend momentum, and now we have the first evidence of resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And with the Chinese economy under duress, the renminbi continuing to make new lows, then the big question is whether demand for Apple's products will hold up, even as their ability to manufacture them is questioned by the COVID zero policy. Now, Tesla was pretty much unchanged in here today, and it's still steadying from the $200 area. And I do wonder about Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter. I'm not so much worried about the whether Twitter is a bastion of the free speech or not. And people espousing various news stories and conspiracy theories over the weekend with regard to Nancy Pelosi's husband is very much beside the point. What I think is a much bigger question is what's going to happen when Chinese vitriol pours, or I guess vitriol against China pours into Twitter, and Elon Musk gets a call from the Communist administration in China and says, and they say to him, "Well, how do you like selling cars here? You're going to have to clamp down on that anti-China sentiment on Twitter." And which way is he going to jump? So this is, I think, part of a broader problem that anyone who does substantial business in China can't be relied upon to be an honest broker. And it's a very tight rope type of scenario that anyone who is living in China, working in Hong Kong, or has business operations in China, that they can proceed with what they would like to do and simultaneously avoid opprobrium from the administration there. So it does beg the question, what's going to happen at Twitter? And we certainly know that Tesla's sales in China have gone up, and he then started making statements supporting a negotiated settlement for Iran and a negotiated settlement for Ukraine. And certainly that would be very desirable from the perspective of China. So this, I think, is going to be a significant touch point over the course of the next 6 months. And of course, we are only about 8 days away from the midterm elections in the USA, and the number of attack ads, I hesitate to call them policy ads, on the media are really getting exceptionally aggressive. So it will be very happy to get past this election. But the Federal Reserve does look likely that they're going to raise rates by 75 basis points a week before the election. And I don't see them pivoting on this occasion. I think that a pivot at some point next year might be reasonable if inflation actually does start to come back down. But we will need to see consumer spending weaken. We'll need to see unemployment rising in order to really confirm that this is a trend that's actually realizable, because right now we have lead indicators that suggest it, but we don't have evidence. And I think the Federal Reserve is now past looking for evidence and, or excuse me, past making forecasts, and will not react until they have clear evidence of a clear trend change in inflationary measures. So I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.